thanks Fire Club and Texas A&M students. So happy to be here with you today. I'm really excited to share this information and to have a chance to talk with you. Before I start, I want to tell you a little bit about who I am. I also want to tell you what I'm not. I think that might be relevant. Let me start by telling you that I'm Mackenzie's father. Very proud of Mackenzie, my wife and I. We have three daughters. Mackenzie's the youngest. And I think all three, as I'll share in a moment, have invested in themselves and become young investors already. My oldest is Morgan. She's a 2015 graduate of in kinesiology and then immediately went on to the Parker School in Dallas. That's where they teach chiropractic doctoring, and she pursued that for over 3 years, became a doctor of chiropractic, and then we're really excited and proud of her that she opened her very own practice, brand new practice in Austin, a little over a year ago in her fifth quarter and just growing great. So she's now not only a doctor of chiropractic, but a business owner. Our middle daughter and her husband, Aaron and Nathan, proud to say that they're 2017 alumni of Texas A&M. I think it's Whoop. Is that how you do it? Okay. And they settled in Austin shortly thereafter, joined the burgeoning high tech community that's happening over there, and immediately began to follow what I'm going to talk about tonight. As a result, today they own not just one, but two homes in the Austin market, one of which they have as investment property. Then we have Mackenzie, who is a young investor of herself, looking to grow and prosper in commercial real estate, such as many of you, I think, are aiming in that direction as well, along with the finance and insurance industry. Great occupations all. Excited to share some information about what I would suggest for all of you. Now, I think the qualifications of why where I come from is that I, along with my brother, my wife, own several businesses. In addition, we have used what I'm gonna talk about tonight to accumulate material holdings in financial securities. That would be the stock market. We also hold raw land that we're holding for development. We have different types of residential real estate investments. And I think it also is material with regard to what I'll be sharing this evening is that none of the things that allowed us to accumulate this did we inherit. So far, we have not inherited anything. So basically, what I'm going to tell you all that I suggest you do, we did too. I also think it's probably important to share before I get into this what I am not. I'm not a registered investment advisor. I'm not a certified financial planner. I don't have any businesses related to that. Maybe that's good for you tonight because there will be no pitch for you to buy my book or go to a seminar or attend a class for a fee. No, I'm just here to share information. But I also am not really qualified to give specific financial advice either. So I'll refrain from doing that and rather attempt to share with you my journey, my story, my wife and I, as we gathered and built assets. Now, let me open it up by saying a couple things, and then we'll get into the meat of the material. First of all, I want it to be interactive. I like to ask questions to see if you're tracking along, and it just helps me because I feed off your energy. So I understand it's a little clumsy with Zoom, but if you have a comment, answer to a question, or wish to ask anything of me or interject into the conversation, I do encourage you to do so. Just unmute and speak up and I'll be quiet and look for what you'd like to say. So I do hope it's interactive and please feel free to do that. I also think that we'll start by queuing up the topic in this way, and I'll do it with a statistic. So researchers estimate that about 1 out of 6 U.S. households reach retirement as a millionaire. 1 out of 6. Now, in my presentation tonight, what I'd like to share with you is to suggest that each and all of you can attain that, 100%. I think what I also hope to convey is that it might be easier than you think. In fact, you might come away thinking that this is easy enough, what Mr. Ellis has shared, that I actually can reach much higher than the goal of just being a millionaire when I turn age, let's say, 65. Perhaps one of you might attain the success of one of your fellow Aggies. By the way, does anybody know why Bucky's has the symbol of a beaver? Anybody know the answer to that? Well, anybody out there in Zoom land? Why does Bucky's choose their symbol as a beaver? No, nothing? Well, it's named after their founder. The fellow's name is Beaver Applin. He is an Aggie, graduate of, I think, 1990. And he went on, obviously, to become a very successful investor. We passed through a Bucky's on our way here. I'm in College Station today. I'm right here at a hotel gathering with your officers, which is great fun. So I came to College Station for this, and we stopped at a Bucky's on our way down. Those things are amazing. And this fellow, Beaver Applin, a Texas Aggie graduate of 1990 approximately, had the foresight and guts to do what he did to create that wonderful corporation. Anyway, my point being that I hope you might take away from this that what Mr. Isles is sharing is so easy, I can reach much higher. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go. Anything so far? All right, so again, my journey to investing success. First, you have to have an ante to play. Anybody know what an ante is? And in what context would you typically hear the word?
Poker.
All right, from the officers here in the room, the answer is poker. Do you have to have an ante to play poker? Yeah, you got to have an ante to play. And what do you suppose is the ante that's required to invest? Brady?
I suppose the ante required to invest would obviously be money.
So Brady here in the room is saying you have to have money to invest. I would agree with that. They don't allow you to invest without money. You have to bring that to the table. Now, so the start of your journey toward investing is having money. And having money for you folks is about having savings. And savings is simply not spending all that you make. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that because I have a strategy to suggest to each of you that I think might be effective for the next several years as you graduate from Texas A&M and depart into your working career. I think there's a pretty easy way to do this if you're willing. Now, raise your hand, please, on the Zoom if you don't make much money now. Not me. All right, so pretty much everybody is in the boat of not making much money now. Now, who, again, next question, plans to make a lot more after you graduate from Texas A&M? All right, I'm seeing hands up. And would you expect each and every year after you've departed here that you're going to make more than you did the year before. Yeah?
Hopefully.
Isn't that your goal? You're Texas A&M Aggies. You graduated from an excellent tier one university. You've got a great education. You've got skills. So while you may start out not making a lot, I think your goal, right, is that each and every year, once you leave here for the foreseeable future, you're going to try to make more than the year before, hopefully a lot more. So that if you graft your income each and every year, it would be a pretty steep line. All right. Now, I'm presuming that because you don't make a lot of money now, you've learned to live on not having a lot of money. Is that true? Yeah, you are pretty frugal. You know, none of you, or not many of you by any stretch, would have a huge budget and spend a lot of money. So you're used to that. So I have a suggestion on how you're going to develop some savings after you leave here. So my suggestion is this. Every time you get a raise, let's just back up a moment. When you first get out of Texas A&M, you take that first job, it's possible you'll start at a low salary, more than you probably have to spend now, let's hope so, but not necessarily a lot. So you might find it difficult just to meet ends meet, you know, just to pay the bills, a transition off of the support you have now to become financially independent. So it could be early on, savings is not easy to accomplish. However, as we suggested earlier, you're looking to make more each and every year. So my suggestion is this. Every time you get a raise, you choose to implement this regimen that you're going to increase your lifestyle on half of the raise and you're going to save the other half. So again, you're going to try to get raises each and every year. You're going to try to make more money each year than the year prior. And as you do that, ramping up from one year to the next for the foreseeable future, because remember, you're Texas A&M graduates, very talented, liable to do well in the marketplace. What I'm suggesting is that with those increases, you spend half and save half. All right. Now, the other possibility is that you take a sales position, some aspect of sales that can be quite lucrative, good career. And sales positions often have two levels of compensation, base and commission or bonus. Base, of course, is usually a subsistence level of earnings. You're going to need all that probably just to survive. But when you make commission and bonus, that's extra, some of which you'll probably need to pay the bills, but hopefully not all of it. So anytime you get a bonus, my suggestion, or a big commission on a deal, my suggestion is to implement right from the get-go, saving part of that. So I am suggesting that with this regimen, if you can hold to it, and again, we've got two of my three daughters out of school, one married now, wonderful son-in-law, Nathan, and they all practice this regimen. Obviously, Morgan needed money to start a business. Aaron and Nathan needed money to be able to buy a house. They now own two of them in Austin, as I mentioned. So, yes, and oh, that's right. Mackenzie's mentioning that, like many of you, Nathan left school with student loans, and they had to be dealt with first. So, again, this regimen that I'm describing can be used to deal with debt as well as savings. And debt, honestly, is your first level of investment because the return on investment is twofold. First, you're saving the interest cost, and second, you're trying to get yourself out from a payment. So your first return on investment is probably to reduce your debt. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go. So with this strategy, if you're willing, within a few years of having left here, especially working hard to develop your career, whatever it is, and then the raises and financial success that comes with doing well in your job, I'm thinking your chances of developing savings are pretty good. Now, there is one substantial enemy, one thing you could do, one thing you should avoid at all costs, because this particular pitfall, financial pitfall, can quickly get in the way of accomplishing these goals. Now, I'm going to turn to the Zoom audience here to see if anybody knows what I'm talking about. So my question is, what pitfall, what decision could you make, what might you do during those first few years after Texas A&M that would greatly impede getting your savings going and being able to invest? Anybody know what I'm talking about?
Spending.
I see Charles John Flynn here. He's unmute and tell me what you're thinking.
Spending, sir.
Go ahead, sorry.
Spending, sir.
Oh, sorry, my volume's not up. My fault. My bad. Go ahead again.
Spending.
Spending. On what in particular way, Charles? What kind of spending would get you in trouble?
Maybe buying a house, whether instead of like buying like an apartment or condo, you know, stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
You could overdo your budget. That's a good point. That would be a good thing. Anybody else have a wanting to chime in on another answer that would get in your way?
A car. Maybe an expensive car payment?
Yes, having expensive cars or expensive car payment. Yep, I agree with that. Anybody else?
Spending to impress people?
Yeah, if you got into that motive where you started deciding to try to keep up with other people with your spending, that could do it. Anything else? All right, go ahead.
One thing that definitely could be an issue is your own little latte factors, like how many times do you have to go to Starbucks versus going and just simply getting, you know, a box.
It's a great point, Brady. Your list of your have-to-haves can certainly get in the way of accomplishing these goals. But let me ask you a more specific question. The one thing that you absolutely want to avoid is to accumulate what kind of debt? In other words, the spending you're talking about, you're all on the right track, but how did you pay for it and what resulted, what do you think I'm talking about? Credit card debt. Absolutely. Have a credit card. In fact, it can be quite useful to you in building your credit rating. Because as we'll talk about later, you're going to need to be able to borrow money to make money. You can't buy a house, and you're right, buying a house before you're ready can get you in some trouble. But to buy a house, you have to borrow money. But credit card debt is unique. Why is that? Why among all the debt is that such so troublesome? Interest expense, Mackenzie says. Anybody know what kind of interest expense they charge for credit cards? Yes, I hear 20%. 20% is a lot of interest that is designed so that you really never escape. A little bit like an addiction, it can grab onto you and hold onto you. And in the process of that, prevent this savings that we're talking about. So many of the suggestions that you talked about, I think are great. like, for example, succumbing to social pressure on what other people have bought. I mean, obviously, having been poor here in school, your desires to purchase are going to be many. And fortunately, the companies and advertisers give you lots of ways to do that. Not to say all that's bad, but what we're saying is two things. As you grow your income, yes, increase your lifestyle, spend half, but save half. And by all means, avoid accumulating credit card debt. That will get in the way quickly. Okay, now, does that mean all debt is bad?
No.
No is correct. All debt is not bad. What kind of debt is good debt to have? Anybody have any ideas? What would be the difference? Well, let me just give you a clue. It's based on what you use to buy with your debt. So we're hearing investment loans, all right? Now, if you're borrowing money for an investment, what are you expecting that asset to do? That's right, increase in value. You're expecting to buy something that increases in value. So when you take on debt to buy something that increases in value, that can be good debt. You've studied this, I'm sure, in your finance classes. I'm seeing on the blog, return on investment. That's right. You're looking at it as something that's going to generate a return. An example of good debt can be student loans. You're investing in yourself. You're looking at using your education to increase your earning potential. And to the extent that you follow through and so that that investment delivers, that can be good debt. It can be good debt. Part of what makes it good debt is it's not so expensive. Obviously, the interest rate or the cost of the debt matters. So 20% is very high, you know, 5 or 6 or 4 or 3 or whatever you have can be good. You need to follow through. It'd be similar to, I suppose, the wonderful visionary Elon Musk, who you probably read is going to build his next car plant not far from here in Austin, spending a lot of money to acquire the land, starting the plant, but not finishing. Somewhere along the way, for whatever reason, not completing the plant, never turns out a car. Well, that's going to turn that expenditure from an investment into an expense quickly. And that can happen in investing for your education as well. So with today's cost of college, it can be inevitable to many that accumulating some student debt is required, but be diligent to make it pay. How you do that is to finish your schooling on time. Time matters. And also use your education to your advantage by going and getting a good job. More than you would have got, a better job than you would have got if you just graduated from high school and gone to work. So again, that's how you can make good debt pay. And I would expect you'd use more debt later on. So let's talk about getting on down the road. Let's say 3 years from now. I'm sorry, not 3 years from now, but 3 years after you've graduated. All right, so 3 years after Texas A&M, you've obviously gotten a job. You've invested in yourself to and worked hard to get your career off the ground. So 3 years later, you're presumably and hopefully making a lot more money than when you left school. Hopefully you have how much credit card debt? None. Big donut hole. You might have a car loan, and maybe you have some leftover student loans that you're still working on getting finished, but nothing else. All right. Now, you've managed your money well. You remembered what we discussed this evening. And as a result, you have an emergency fund. Anybody know how many months you're supposed to cover with your emergency fund? 6 months. Got lots of answers here. 6 months is correct. So you do need an emergency fund. And then beyond that, you have some extra funds. You've saved beyond that 6 month need. So congratulations. You have your ante. And as a result, you're ready to play. Okay. Now, the first place I would suggest that you play is what I would have done early in my career when I happened to work for a company that offered a 401k plan. Probably familiar that a 401k is a company-sponsored plan that it's called a qualified plan that allows you to invest in the stock market and various funds, accumulation of stocks and potentially bonds. And in particular, if the company you're working for offers a matching contribution, then that's like free money that's being offered to you that you should take advantage of. So a match would typically say that for every dollar you put into the fund, they're going to match. It could be 100% of it, could be 50%, could be 150%. The terms vary between companies, but as long as the company is matching in some way, I'm suggesting that you take advantage of this. Yes.
So is that something that you take if it's offered, or is that something that you can negotiate if it's not offered?
So Mackenzie's asking whether it's a negotiable term in employment. And I think the answer to my understanding is no, it's not negotiable. And the reason of that is that companies by law have to offer it to all their full-time employees or none of them. I don't think they can choose and offer it discriminately. So I'm suggesting that's the first place that you might invest because of the match. It's also pretty convenient. Now, the next choice that you would have to make, typically, if they offer a 401k, is whether to choose what's called a Roth 401k or a non-Roth 401k. Now, the non-Roth is the standard 401k that's existed for some time. I think the legislation that created 401ks dates back to the 1970s. The Roth IRA is more recent. Now, the way the difference works, well, let me ask you, does anybody know the difference?
I can explain the difference.
Ellen is chiming in. What do you think, Ellen?
So Roth IRA, you don't get taxed on the gain. So everything that you make, you just get to take straight out and you don't get taxed. But on a traditional, you would be taxed on all the gains that you've made. So throughout your life, it would accumulate to a lot.
Okay, Ellen. Yes. Exactly. So they're exactly reverse on when you pay taxes. So as Ellen explained, if you elect a Roth, you pay the taxes now. But in return, when you take the money out long down the road, it's not taxed. No taxes on the end. The standard 401k is exactly the opposite. You don't pay taxes now, but you do have to pay them when you take the money out, when you actually use it. Now, so the basic decision on whether to do Roth or not has to do with what is your expectation on taxes? Would it be better to pay the taxes now or later? Any votes from the audience? Well, generally, you don't want to pay taxes now, but why might you want to pay the taxes now in that Roth scenario?
We're in a much smaller tax bracket now.
It could be. The taxes could be much greater later. So if you think the taxes are lower now and are likely to be greater later, based on the state of government finances, then electing a Roth might be a very smart decision.
Wouldn't it be like that's something that you put your money into that would, you know, you wouldn't take out until so far in the future that it doesn't really make sense for you to try to be like, oh, well, they could be higher in the future. It's so far into the future that you don't really know.
So Mackenzie's basically saying it. This is regarding cash I'm going to use so far into the future that I really shouldn't necessarily be concerned about the taxes. And that's really, you know, potentially true. I mean, it's a choice. They offer both. And Mackenzie makes a good point that, okay, you know, if I don't pay taxes now, I'll have more to invest because I'm not paying the taxes off the top. So that's a benefit. So it's hard to know the exact answer on this, but the good news is they do offer both. But I'm suggesting you take advantage of that. Now, what if your company doesn't offer a 401k? Or maybe they do, but they don't offer a matching contribution. So that's certainly a possibility. Then if it was me, I would suggest instead you open an IRA account. That's called an individual retirement account, which is basically the same premise of a 401k. It's just that you're doing it for yourself. Of course, it doesn't have any matching contributions I mentioned. It's all your money. However, we're talking about the same thing, how to create mailbox money later on when we need it, how to make our money work for us as hard as we're gonna work. And we can accomplish that through an IRA as well. Same issue, they make IRAs in both Roth and non-Roth version. And as we've discussed, which one you choose has to do with your view of taxes. Do I pay them now? Do I pay them later? All right, next, what to invest in? What do I invest in? So for myself, I chose mutual funds. Now, more recently, they have devised a similar strategy called exchange-traded funds. But basically, they have the same concept. They're groups of stocks that have been put together into one fund. So when you invest in this fund, essentially by way of buying a share, you're really buying shares of lots of companies. Now that has an advantage because you probably know you want to diversify. You don't want to have your so-called eggs in just one basket. One very popular exchange-traded fund that many people invest in is called the S&P 500. You're probably familiar with that, being Fire Club members. And you would know that that's a collection of our country's 500 largest companies. 500, there's a lot of companies. These are the biggest ones. So that basket of stocks is a pretty solid investment. You buy in there and it mimics the collective return of all those companies combined. Now let me check this out. The question is coming in, what about cryptocurrency? Okay, so here is my answer. This is coming from Jacob. So I'll give a general answer, not specifically about cryptocurrency, but I think the general answer from my point of view is to invest in things you understand. You don't need to know it all about, but to invest in companies that you have some knowledge of, I think is helpful. Personally, I don't yet understand cryptocurrency. So that could be, again, the next biggest thing that could be a widely adopted and useful in as a great investment, or it could be a complete sham. I wouldn't know the difference. So just from my own point of view, I'm not comfortable in investing in that, but that doesn't mean you should be if you have a good understanding of what this is. The one thing about the S&P 500 is it has a track record. And I like investing in probabilities. I think poker players like investing in probabilities, or even gamblers going to Las Vegas at the blackjack table tend to want to get into their situations where the odds are on their side. And that's when they double down, they put on a lot of money, they go for broke, they try to win when they know the probabilities are with them. If they sense that's not the case, they may fold. Now, the good news about the S&P 500 is that over the last 9 decades, that would be 90 years, and just to do the math, that would take us back to 1930. You might recall that 1930 was right after the stock market crashed. So the stock market was very low in 1930. You probably remember from history that those were the depression years, and that it lasted a while. So these 9 decades I'm talking about, in which I'm gonna share the average return for the S&P 500, include the depression years. And I would say the S&P 500 track record over that 9 decades is quite attractive. In fact, the average annual return over that time frame is almost 10%, actually 9.8 to be exact. 9.8% per year over 90 years adds up. So with that, I'd like to share some more advice for you based on where you are now, which is you're young. You have time on your side. You are going to go into a career, again, hopefully have rapidly rising income as a result of leveraging this education you've received here, and you're going to have money in your pocket to spend. And if you choose, as we've discussed tonight, to invest part of it for your future, let me share some statistics of the power of that. So I mentioned 3 years after graduating here. It's kind of your, you know, that time frame where you've accomplished, you put yourself in a position to invest. So I'm going to average that out and call it age 25. 25 years of age, approximately, when you're 3 years out of Texas A&M. And let's say, based on putting yourself into position to play, you invest just $100 per month, $100 per month in the S&P 500 index fund. No match, no help from the company. You're just your $100 a month. And but you're consistent with it. You've created margin in your life by saving some, not spending everything you make, and therefore $100 a month. By the way, is that very much money? No. $100 a month. How many things do you spend $100? You know, you're talking about the have-to-haves, the little stuff. You can spend $100 a month on lots of things, including, amazingly, coffee. Remarkable.
Marcus said I can spend it one morning sitting on Amazon.
One morning on Amazon and enjoying yourself with what the deals of the day, $100 can go out the door quickly. So you're right, $100 a month, that's 30 days, oh my gosh. So it would not take long to come up with $100 a month or to spend it. But back to the subject at hand, $100 a month, every month, S&P 500, and assuming that the return over the next 40 years is the same as the last 90 years, you would have invested over that time a total of $48,000. So $100 a month, 40 years, do the math, it turns out to be your money, how much money you've got in the deal, $48,000. Again, $100 a month is not a lot of money, $48,000 of total lifetime investment, that's not impressive. Our Beaver Applin would not be impressed with that level of investment budget. But to illustrate the power, any one venture, how much that fund would be worth at age 65, that S&P 500 fund, assuming that it achieves the same thing as the historical average. How much is your $48,000 worth at age 65? Anybody venture a guess? I'll look at the chats. All right, somebody's got their calculator out. I can see because there's no answers coming in. They're probably, they don't want to be baited into this. You're going to need your Excel spreadsheet. It's 9.8% compounded. Ellen says over a million. No, not quite that much, but that's a good guess.
$200,000.
Okay, Mackenzie's guess is $200,000. That's a pretty good guess. That takes that $48,000 and quadrupled it. But the answer is no, it's more than that. I've got, let's see, it says Charles John about $500,000. He's closer, but not quite. It's more. Yeah, you're right there, real close. The answer from Aaron, $650,000, he's very close. I came up with $600,000 after that 40-year time frame. So given the fact that we only had to put $48,000 in, again, $100 a month, $1,200 a year, you can imagine how easy it is to get to retire as a millionaire at 65 based on just cranking it up a little bit. Let's do some math here. $1,200 a year, we got to get about half again more. So I'm going to need about $2,000 a year of input to end up with $1 million at age 65. So two points I want you to take away. One, I've said it before, it bears repeating, time is on your side. Now, let's illustrate that a little bit further on why this is so important. If you wait until 35 to start investing, let's say you got caught up in nasty credit card debt, or as one of the suggestions came in earlier, you got caught up in trying to keep up with those on social media, they're buying lots of stuff and you like that stuff. We all like stuff. So you bought it too, didn't really save, and only got serious investing when you're 35. Again, that same $100 a month, how much is that worth 30 years later? Any ideas? Remember, it was $600,000 if we put 40 years into it. We're going to trim 10 years off, same $100 a month. What's that worth at 65? Anybody guess?
$300,000
is too high. You're getting closer. Keep going down. Less than 240. It's 218. So for cutting off 1/4 of the time, I only get 36%, a little over a third of the benefit. Let me illustrate another thing. Let's say you procrastinate till you're age 45. You know, those boats and cars and vacations, and of course you had some kids, and there's lots of things to spend money on that can start to increase. You don't get really going until you're 45. Half the time, 40 years from 25 to 65, 45, you got 20 years to go. you put in the $100 a month, how much is that worth at age 65? You are close, $75,000. So for cutting out half the years, you only get 1/8 of the benefit. Half the years, 1/8 of the benefit. So again, I'm going to repeat myself. I want you to get this through. Time is on your side, but you've got to make that time pay. You've got to get started early. Let's talk about an example that could get in the way. So you go out after you graduate here, and you're probably going to, maybe you're going to need a new truck. All right. Maybe the one that you're driving now is, you know, I'm hypothesizing your situation, but let's say you got it in high school. Maybe it was used when your parents gave it to you. By the time you graduate from Texas A&M, and perhaps you get it to go a little longer, which would be great, but you buy a new truck. Now, what I want to talk about is that the dealer that you bought it from says, you know, that's a nice truck you're buying. How about we equip it with a new set of custom wheels? And you say, boy, those wheels look great. Gosh, they're black, they're big. I got the, they're 22s, maybe they spin. I don't know, that's probably a decade ago, I'm sorry. But anyway, you got these nice new wheels, and the wheels add only $1,000 to the cost of the truck. Now, you roll it into the loan, 5-year loan. So when you get done paying for the wheels, because you didn't have the cash to begin with, the wheels end up costing a bit more because of interest. So instead of $1,000, around $1,200 with the interest over 5 years. That's about $25 a month. Now, $25 a month, again, doesn't seem like a lot of money. So when you're sitting in the finance office at the dealership talking about these wheels, you're saying, oh, you know, $25 a month, that's chump change. That is not a lot of money. Sure, put it on. But if you take that $25 a month off the table from investing, because obviously you spent it on the wheels, my question is twofold. 5 years later, how much are the wheels worth? Can you sell these custom wheels 5 years later? Not likely to be getting any money out of the custom wheels. All right. Maybe they increase the value of the truck when you sell it marginally. Typically not. But if you invested it, how much does that add up to 40 years later? Any guesses? Remember, it was $1,000 to start with. I'm looking on the...
That was for the wheels.
So $25 a month. I didn't, because I would have financed it. Instead, I put that in the S&P 500 fund, $25 a month. They could do that now because they allow fractional buying in the investment accounts. Really cool. I've got an answer from Jacob, $12,000. No, it's more than that. So $1,000 is not $12,000. It's actually not. It's more than that. Any guesses beyond that? I've got $20,000. No, it's more than that. The answer is $41,000. So small decisions such as you make in your 20s can lead to vast differences 40 years later when you're thinking, you know, that mailbox money sounds pretty good, Mr. Isles. I want my money to work as hard as I have. How hard has it been working? Yep, Charles John says 45,000. I think that's about right. So again, because of the power of time, small decisions you make in your 20s can yield vast differences later on. And I think that's the point I want to make, because you have that advantage. Time is on your side. Now, for those of you in the Zoom audience that would say, I'd never buy custom wheels for my truck, that's not me. I wouldn't buy a truck. Let me just point out that lots of things that we buy cost an extra $25 a month. 25 is peanuts. You could have a subscription of this and that of lots of stuff that costs that much money. So this applies to everybody on the Zoom, regardless of maybe it's not truck wheels, but it is something that costs that much. So again, it's about having a goal, obviously getting here to Texas A&M and the main campus here in College Station wasn't easy. Not everybody gets to attend. You probably had to establish that goal well before you arrived here, that I needed to get good enough grades, I need to have the academic career, I need to have the extracurricular activities, I need to have the package so I would be accepted here. In the same way, you're looking ahead down the road to accomplish your financial goals. Nothing, Rome wasn't built in a day, they say. You've got to look ahead and think ahead to accomplish these things. Now, I'll wrap it up with a few more thoughts, and then I'd be glad to take some questions. First of all, I want to return to this common thought I've said, that time is on your side. Now, where that comes into play is in this fact. I mentioned that the S&P 500 has averaged 9.8%, almost 10% over the last 9 decades, 90 years. But you probably know, well, maybe you don't, that it didn't go straight up. It'd be nice if it did, 9.8% every single year, like clockwork. That would make it easy, but it didn't do that. It zigzagged. It had spurts like we had a year or two ago where it went up over 30%. It had years where it stayed sideways for a decade. It had years where it went down. But in general, it goes up and to the right. So it's a good investment. But during those down periods of time, we have to manage our own emotions because obviously we have a choice in those downturns, just like we had this year in March of bailing out. You know, the market went down in a hurry in March when COVID was announced and the lockdowns began. And a lot of people panicked, all right? And some should, because the general rule of thumb is if you need the money soon as defined within 5 years, then these market issues can really affect you. But I got good news for all of you. Your time horizon is much longer at 25 years old and 30 years old. Again, we're looking to go to mailbox money that we're going to start drawing out in our 60s. I just turned 60. It's fun to go get mailbox money, I can tell you that. And I think you'll enjoy it too. But it's not something we're going to do in the near term. So let me leave you with this one thought. The value of your investments only matters when you're doing what? At what point does the value of it matter? When you sell it, when you need it, that's when it matters. Until then, it's only academic. Money on paper doesn't matter. So that's right. When you take it out to spend it, that's when it matters. So as long as you don't need it, because you don't have it within your spending profile, because you have margin in your life, you don't need that money to spend, then it doesn't matter. All right. So I want to impress upon you, because the only way to get to the goal, the end goal, is consistency and time. If I bail on it, if I try to time the market, my own experience is that has not worked well. Let me give you one story from my own personal life. We'll go on. So in the late 90s, we had another excellent stock market, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99. And then 2000, great years for the market, up, up, and up. This was the start of the internet boom. This was the start of the high-tech era we're still in today. The iPhone, I think, was invented in the middle 90s, if I recall correctly, and a whole new aspect of technology came about during that time. And so the stock market was on fire. And I missed just about all of it because I didn't, I just couldn't get myself to invest. I don't know why. I was trying to time the market at the time and it just seemed expensive. Every time I thought it was expensive, it went up and that made it more expensive and I missed out. Well, come 1999, right before the millennium, I decided, well, I must be wrong. All right. So I invested in 1999. I don't know if anybody remembers what happened in 2000. Yeah, it was a big, big decline in 2000. Big, big decline. The bubble burst. Now, stock market bubbles can absolutely happen. Again, this market does not go up linearly. It's more like a stepping pattern. But consistently, it does go up and to the right, as I mentioned. Anyway, so I bought in 99 and it went down in 2000. And guess what I did? Yeah, you're right. I sold. Well, I bought right before I should have kept. I'm sorry. I bought when I shouldn't have. I bought way too late and I sold when I shouldn't have. So I got whipsawed on exactly the opposite of the deal. Now, let's just say I didn't ignore what the market was doing and instead invested that consistent amount of money every month and forgot about what it was going on. Why? Well, I'm only in my, I was in my 30s then. I don't need the money then. It didn't matter to me then. So if I'd have just stayed the course and held on and invested consistently, irrespective of what the Mr. Market was doing, I'd have been so much better off. And that's my advice to you. Of course, sharing my experience is, forget about it. It only matters when you sell it. And if that time horizon's a long way off because you don't need the money, then it's not of value to you. All right. Now, I want you to consider some statistics that I put together to back this up. Because I mentioned earlier, you want to invest in things where the probabilities are on your side. So let me share some things about that. Let me share during the last, I think during the entire history of our stock market, that would date back to the late 1800s, there has been no, I repeat that, no 20-year period where the stock market declined. No 20-year period. It always, you know, in other words, if you bought it, pick any 20-year period, any month, 20 years later, your market is higher than it was 20 years prior. All right, 100%. Are the historical odds that you'll make money over 20 years. So if your time horizon is greater than 20 years, the probabilities are with you. Let's just share some others. Even over 10 years, the historical odds of the market being higher 10 years later, 94%. Those are pretty good odds. All right. I mean, I think the bookies in Las Vegas, the guys playing poker, would think 94% odds are ones they would bet money on. Even over as little as 5 years, just 5 years, the historical odds of making money are 87%. 87, that's pretty good odds too. But for a time period of just 1 year, historically the market goes up, you know, maybe 3/4 of the time and goes down about 1/4. But it also can go sideways and do nothing for several years. So in any given year, you really don't know whether it's going to go up or down. And I want to share something that's really cool about this. Who cares what the market does this year? I don't care if I don't need the money. If my time horizon's much longer, then it does not matter. The odds are with you as time goes on. So I hope you remember that. Now, I'll close with this one thought, because I've illustrated stock market investing. I spent most of my time on that because it's easy. In fact, over the time that I've been an investor, leading us here to 2020, it's become easier and easier every year. You would know probably that the cost of trading stocks has gone to zero. Wasn't always that way. Used to be fairly high transaction costs. Now you can have an account, have almost little or no transaction cost. You can trade fractional shares. This is cool. So investing in the stock market has never been easier. All electronic, money moves right out of your accounts. Don't have to write a check. It's just super easy. Not only that, you can, again, increase it or reduce it. You can go up and down. As long as, you know, like I said, you try to maintain a certain minimum to achieve your goals. So it's easy. It also has been profitable. So I share that as being applicable and suggest it for all of you. But you're probably aware there are bigger returns available to you in other investment classes. All right. Certainly, that's absolutely true. You could start a business. Obviously, that has the opportunity to make a lot more money. You have the opportunity to invest in various aspects of real estate. I think I love real estate. I think it's great. As I mentioned in my introduction, my wife and I have accumulated holdings in several different classes of real estate. We think it's wonderful. However, I would tell you this. They all involve more risk. And I'll explain why. They all more involve more risk because in most cases, you have to borrow money to play. So this ante I've described goes up, not just $100 a month, not just having some margin. No, you've got to have more money because you have to service debt. The time horizons might be longer. The ability to liquidate might be more difficult. So again, other investment classes of assets absolutely offer better returns. And I encourage you to explore that because you're going to be super successful as Texas A&M grads, but it does involve more risk. Now, as you use debt, you have to probably create a little more margin in your budget because you do not want to run out of money while you're holding on to a debt-financed asset. Staying power is key. We're going to learn a lot about that over the next year as COVID has really wrecked investment classes. And basically, whether people survive or not in these investments has to do entirely with their cash cushion, their staying power. That's going to get tested a lot over the next year or two. Those that survive are going to do great, I think. It's going to come back. It's going to be fabulous, I believe. But there could be a lot of casualties that didn't make it out because of that ability to have cash. So I encourage you to, as you leave Texas A&M, to have high goals beyond that of just what I've suggested in the stock market. I think it's a great, I suggest to be part. I do encourage you to do more than that, but it does involve more risk. So you have to decide, each one of you yourself, how much you wanting to accept. All right. Well, thank you for your time and attention. I've really enjoyed talking with you. I'll take any questions if you have any.